Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America in this honorable court.
Welcome back to CAF Chats. I am Major Rhian Wentz, and today I am joined by...
Hi, this is Colonel Trevor Barna, Chair of the Criminal Law Department.
You know, sir, it's been a little while since we've updated, but we've been busy at the school with the OBC, the GDP, and the JAOAC. I'm sure I've missed some letters, but we are back and excited to talk about United States versus Liepert. I think that's how we decided it was pronounced. Let's jump right in with the procedural history and facts.
So, Liepert, I'm not sure how we're saying that, but it was a mixed plea case. There, he pled guilty to one specification of aggravated assault, two specifications of assault consummated by a battery, and two specifications of wrongfully communicating threats. Contrary to his pleas, he was convicted of two specifications of sexual assault. Notably, and it's very important later on in the court's ruling, the military judge acquitted Liepert of one specification of communicating a threat, two specifications of sexual assault, and one specification of the lesser included offense of attempted sexual assault. All the charges and specifications involved Liepert and one victim. That said, the actual facts of the case aren't really that relevant for our purposes in this conversation. The most important thing to know is that Liepert pled guilty to some of the offenses, but contested several of the others. After the Providence inquiry, the military judge accepted Liepert's pleas, then the contested portion of the trial began, and that's where all the problems really begin. During his opening statement, the civilian defense counsel referenced the mixed guilty plea, and he told the military judge that they were going to ask you at the end of this particular case to enter a not guilty finding as to the remaining charges and specifications. After then a somewhat confusing back and forth about what that meant, the military judge finally concluded with, quote, "So we're operating in a world where I'm aware of the previous guilty plea." Defense counsel's response was, "Of course, sir, yes." Then in its closing argument, the government referenced the mixed plea by saying things like, quote, "The defense counsel asked you to operate in this world where you know that he pled guilty to a number of offenses. So right now I want to talk about how that goes toward the victim's credibility, because you're standing here operating in this world where he has admitted to crimes against Ms. KC, the victim. The government, referring to themselves in the third person, believes you can use that in assessing her credibility on the stand." Essentially, in this case, the government argued that Liepert admitted to some crimes against the victim. So, of course, why would she be lying about the rest, against arguing that her credibility was supported by his guilty plea? Following, there was a Dubay hearing to answer whether or not the defense counsel was ineffective by allowing the military judge to consider the guilty plea, or that part of the guilty plea, in finding him not guilty or guilty of the remaining charges. Ultimately, the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals wouldn't decide whether the performance was deficient, but instead decided the IAC issue on prejudice. They held that Liepert, quote, "failed to demonstrate a reasonable probability of a more favorable result." And given the absence of evidence that the trial judge misused Liepert's guilty pleas.
So, sir, basically what we're dealing with is a bunch of charges and specifications that all kind of relate around one victim. The accused, or the appellant in this case, pled guilty to some of them and then contested some of them. And so what did CAF grant on? What was the problem here?
The two granted issues from CAF were, one, whether trial defense counsel were ineffective for allowing the military judge to consider appellant's guilty plea when determining whether appellant was guilty of the contested offenses, and two, whether the trial counsel's, quote, "clear error" in the findings argument, that is, leveraging appellant's guilty plea to prove his guilt of the contested offenses, whether that was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
So before we talk about how CAF analyzed the granted issues, first of all, in one of the issues, CAF has inter alia. I had to go look this up because despite having been an appellate attorney, I didn't know exactly what it meant. So you probably know, sir, as a former military judge, but I looked it up in my handy dandy Black's Law Dictionary, and it is among other things. So if our listeners don't get anything else from this podcast, they get a Latin lesson.
I did note that you had inter alia in our script. I, of course, skipped over it because I didn't want to be that guy. But yeah, I did actually have to look it up as well. So I appreciate the vote of confidence, but I did not know either.
Well, and sir, you've let everybody now know that there is a script. So you're, you know, really showing folks a lot behind the curtain. But let's get back to what we're here to talk about. In terms of the granted issues, there's a couple of threshold principles, and those two things are the use of guilty pleas and the presumption that military judges know and follow the law. So first, regarding the guilty pleas, in United States versus Flores, CAF held that a guilty plea and related statements to one offense cannot be admitted to prove any element of a separate offense. And a military judge must not later rely on those statements as proof of a separate offense. To do so would compel an accused to incriminate herself in the separate criminal proceeding. The fundamental argument that Liepert is making to CAF is that if the military judge used his statements during the guilty plea, that usurped his right to remain silent as to the contested offenses. Really, I'm just playing with fire in this script with usurped and inter alia. Anyway, secondly, the military judge is presumed to know the law. The CAF here cites to United States versus Erickson, and in that case, the court held that not only are military judges presumed to know the law, but are also presumed to follow it, absent clear evidence to the contrary. This presumption and that clear evidence requirement does a lot of work here in Liepert, but we'll get to that in just a second. So first, let's talk about the IAC issue. That was the first issue that CAF analyzed, and as we've discussed several times on this podcast, to establish IAC, the appellant has to show deficient performance and prejudice. And we know that this is a tough burden for appellant to meet because courts presume that defense lawyers are sufficient. And even if appellant is able to overcome this presumption, they have to show that but for the deficient performance, the result would have been different. In this case, CAF ultimately held that Liepert's defense attorneys were not deficient. There was a lot of analysis by the AFCCA, basically parsing the language in the record. And what it comes down to is that there was no clear evidence the military judge failed to follow Flores in this case, which is that you can't use the statements from a guilty plea in the contested for the contested charges and specifications. Because, and CAF said, the record does not indicate that the defense counsel agreed that the military judge would consider the guilty plea, nor is that what the military judge stated he would do. Rather, the military judge was merely aware of the guilty pleas. So because the military judge was just aware of the guilty pleas, but there's no evidence that the military judge actually considered the guilty plea, there was no deficient performance and therefore no IAC. So the second related issue was the government's closing argument, where they referenced the guilty plea and basically asked the military judge to use that guilty plea in evaluating the victim's credibility. Liepert argued to CAF that it was an improper argument. But before we get into the substance, let's pause for a minute to discuss the standard of review. I know that Major Morgan and Major Barrett aren't here to nerd out about it, and I think we can get by without them. Mostly because CAF lays it out pretty clearly in this case. CAF reviews improper argument and prosecutorial misconduct de novo, which is basically a fresh look. This is opposed to abuse of discretion, where there is essentially a presumption that the judge got it right. Now, when there is no objection, CAF reviews the issue for plain error, in which the appellant bears the burden to demonstrate error that is clear or obvious and results in material prejudice to his substantial rights. Where a forfeited constitutional error was clear or obvious, material prejudice is assessed using the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard. So put another way, and this is as Chief Judge Olson does in his concurrence, when the error is of constitutional magnitude, the government bears the burden of demonstrating that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. So the government has to prove that the error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. That standard is met where a court is confident that there is no reasonable possibility that the error might have contributed to the conviction. So all of that is to say is that when there's an error of constitutional magnitude, the government has a really heavy burden to show that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in order for that conviction to stand. Now, the constitutional issue here, which we a little bit talked about, was the use of the guilty plea violating Liepert's right against self-incrimination, which is, of course, in the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution. Now, in this case, CAF held that the trial counsel using Liepert's guilty plea to bolster the government's argument was, in fact, clear error. Because it was clear error, CAF then had to determine whether the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The government argued that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because of that presumption that Colonel Barna talked about earlier regarding the military judge's ability to know and follow the law. CAF held that even though the trial counsel misstated the law, CAF cannot presume, and that's a quote, the military judge adopted trial counsel's view of the law. The misstatements by the trial counsel are not imputed to the military judge, absent evidence that the military judge adopted the rationale of the misstatements. Accordingly, according to CAF, there was no reasonable possibility that the error might have contributed to appellant's conviction. So all of that is to say, ultimately, at the end of the day, CAF upholds Liepert's conviction, even though there was an argument by the government counsel and possibly a questionable argument by the defense counsel for the military judge to use the Providence inquiry and the guilty pleas as part of the contested case. So we talked a lot about appellate standards of review, and basically, you know, they got the law wrong. So, sir, what are some takeaways for the field, do you think?
Well, so again, knowing the law on mixed pleas is really critical in a case like this where you're questioning how the judge should look at the evidence before him or her, and understanding, particularly in mixed pleas where it's a judge-alone contest. In a mixed plea case, it's important how the portion of the trial where the accused pled guilty is going to come in, if at all. That's a tactical decision by counsel if you've got a panel. It's less so with respect to the court, as is evident in this case. You know, it's fascinating when you look at how the simple word aware was used. And we've, you know, emphasized it a couple times here, but in the Dubay hearing, the judge who held the Dubay review said that the trial court considered, and the CAF comes back in and says, well, that's not what they said. And in fact, what they said was the judge said simply that he was aware of the mixed plea, not that he would consider it in using one or the other. And so it's that small but critical word, consider versus aware. The Dubay judge said it was considered, it was wrong, and then that's what CAF relied on, was simply because the judge was aware doesn't mean that that was an error, that they used the information incorrectly or they used the mixed pleas incorrectly against the accused or against Liepert here.
And sir, I just want to ask a question based on that. You know, it really emphasizes the importance of the words that we're using on the record, and it emphasizes the importance of a clear record. So from your experience, what are some ways that counsel can help a judge make and keep a clean record?
So in this case, if you look at the conversation that the judge and defense counsel are having with one another, it's not very clear that they understand what the other person is asking. And so I think, you know, we talk about this being a little bit of a confusing conversation between the two. I'm not sure the defense understood what the judge was getting at. And I'm not confident that that was clear when the judge makes the ultimate decision that and says on the record, okay, fine, I'm aware of it. In this world, I'm aware of it. And so I think CAF had to rely on the information that it had, which was the judge simply said, I'm aware. Never said I'm going to consider it. Never said that it goes to anything other than I understand. The complexity here is the trial judge in a judge-alone case does go back and forth between the fact finder and then determining interlocutory issues that he has to be clear on the record, she has to be clear on the record what they're doing given the particular issue.
Yeah, and I think, you know, kind of a tangent on the point that you were making earlier in terms of knowing the law, I think one of the ways that as counsel, it's really important for us to help the record, help the judge, help the case is, you know, knowing the law, doing your research, like, you know that this is going to be an issue. I don't know. It wasn't clear from the record, I don't think. And sir, you can correct me. I don't know if this is a naked plea or if this was pursuant to some kind of plea agreement. But either way, if it's a mixed plea, you know that this is going to come up. And so you absolutely have to have researched this issue. Like, this shouldn't be something that you are answering on the fly. And quite frankly, I think, especially based on Leeper and based on Flores, I mean, if I were the defense counsel, I would make a specific point to have that conversation with the judge before opening as sort of like a preliminary matter to take up before we started the contested case, just as like a means of making sure that we're all on the same page, for lack of a better descriptor.
I do think that's one way to do it. Another way is, as kind of you're intimating, before the judge makes the or gets into the providency inquiry, the conversation could happen before then. Judge could ask the parties what their understanding of how this is going to go forward, how the parties anticipate the guilty plea portion will be used, or in this case, not be used, so it's clear on the record, and also to telegraph to, or just state clearly to government counsel to avoid these kinds of errors. You know, as we talked about in the introduction, the CAF looked at the judge's findings with respect to the not guilty offenses and said, this is clearly other evidence that it was not prejudice because he balanced all of the evidence and made a determination that the accused was not guilty of those offenses. And therefore, it must have been that the judge correctly used the law and understood it because he found the accused not guilty of these other offenses. And so I understand CAF's analysis. I think we can be more clear in our practice by resolving some of these issues ahead of time. And you can do that also by asking for breaks, asking the judge to take a recess so that you can clarify what those questions are, and then researching whatever it is that is before the parties rather than trying to rush to failure. And I'm not saying this was a failure, but it did feel as though there was not a meeting of the minds between the trial judge and the counsel.
So the two takeaways are, and I as we were preparing for this podcast, sir, I struggled with takeaways for the field other than know the law, because that's what they're doing here with the podcast. And I know that that's what every counsel's intention is. But when you can prepare for issues, when you can see something is going to be a problem, then, you know, take it off the table. Make sure that you're prepared to answer the question. And if you're not, if it is something that kind of surprises you, then and the judge asks you a question and you need a minute to research it, you know, just ask for that minute. I know that standing at counsel table and saying, I don't know, Your Honor, can I have a minute to go look, is not anybody's favorite thing to do. But I think judges would so much rather that happen than answer off the cuff, which I think is one of the cardinal sins of any attorney, right? Okay, sir, do you have anything else for the field?
Well, the other thing we talked about with respect to mixed pleas is, again, knowing the nuances and how it will play out in your case. You know, one of the other things we talked about is, what about in those cases where somebody is pleading guilty to a lesser included?
Oh, right, sir.
That may be an opportunity for you to do the research beforehand. How does this look? What does it mean for the case going forward if my client is pleading guilty to almost all of the elements, but not everything?
So, for example, something like AWOL and desertion.
Right. Or some type of, you know, battery, assault consummated by, or whatever it may be. If the accused has agreed to certain elements, but not all of what the government has charged, how does that look? What are your limitations? What should you say or not say in order to avoid these kinds of errors?
Thank you, sir. I think that's all we've got for United States versus Liebert. We'll be back in about 2 weeks. Give us a little grace if it's a little bit behind, but we're working on getting back on our regular schedule. So thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next time for CAF Chats.
We're here.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General's or the Department of the Army or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. And the court will stand in recess until further order of the court.